Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Peter Breggin. I'm really glad to be with you today. I'm really excited about my guest today. I've had Jeannie Stolzer on the air. The first time was April 1st. Maybe it was the second time was April 1st. April 1st, 2015. I went out to Jeannie's place, where she's a professor, to the University of Nebraska in Kearney, Nebraska, professor of child development, really child and adolescent development. Jeannie's a specialist in that area, a specialist in attachment theory, which I believe is one of the most important viewpoints on human beings, human life, human nature that we can have. She is a specialist also in human evolution in terms of our early development as mammals and the nurturing aspects of human relationship. And beyond that, Jeannie's just a lot of fun. She's interesting. She's exciting. She had a very healthy influence on my most recent book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. Because of her, I went back and read some of my own roots in attachment theory, and thought a little more deeply about it for the evolution of guilt, shame, and anxiety, as well as my own thinking for years and years now about how to overcome those negative emotions in order to live and love. So when I do a show with Jeannie, or when I talk to Jeannie on the phone, or when I go to visit Jeannie, it's always a bit like walking into fireworks. I'm never sure just what the bursts are going to look like, but I know there will be fun and excitement. Jeannie, I hear you there.
Yes, I had to laugh on that one. Fireworks. Hi, this is Peter Breggin again. I don't know how much folks out there heard all the fumbling and bumbling with technologies on both ends. My guest, Jeannie Stolzer, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi. I can hear you.
Yay. Well, I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, good. I'm glad to talk to you. I'm just going to go on here and chat with you about your wonderful work and our mutual interests, which include everything from dogs to nursing, and by nursing I mean nursing at the human breast of infants, everything from the evolution of people to the evolution of dogs. I mean, that's just not everything. We're getting pretty focused here. And I've been growing in more and more interest in the whole area of where dogs meet people. Nobody knows exactly when. Is it the general theory is 15,000 years ago with villages? I don't think so. I think the dogs had to be evolving up to that by following our camps. We just haven't found their fossils yet because their camps are all over the place, whereas the villages are in one place. But anyway, that's my story. Jeannie, where do you want to go with this show today?
Well, I love how you're talking about dogs, because I think that as scientists, we pretend like we know much more than we really know. And I'm with you. I think dogs have been our constant companions probably since the inception of the hominid race. That's what I think.
Well, it's interesting because they don't show up. You know, Jeannie, they don't show up, in the, quote, in the fossil record until 15,000 years ago, the beginning of villages and people being stationary. But I think that is probably because before that, they were few in numbers following our camps. We were nomads. Heck, how in the heck are we going to in the roulette of sticking picks into the ground looking for fossils? How are we going to necessarily come upon some of the early dogs? I'm not sure, because we come upon so early, so few early humans, in fact.
Well, I think that we may be getting in trouble here, because it's hard to distinguish canine lupus, you know, from the what we call the modern-day dog. So how the wolf evolved, you know, that's up to speculation right now. But I do believe, and I absolutely 100% believe, that they've been with us for a very, very long time, much longer than 15,000 years. I think that human beings are innately longing for unconditional love and acceptance and to feel safe, to be valued, to have someone they can trust, to know that no matter what, they're loved. And that's what we've always had with dogs. And nobody's going to make me believe it's 15,000 years. And if you look at the scientific record, we've been wrong so very many times. So that's just an initial theory in my mind.
Yeah, Ginger just, in that regard, sent across my table a day or two ago. That's my wife, folks, for those of you who don't know much about me. But she sent across my table a scientific study showing that some creatures that we thought had died off millions and millions of years before they did have now been found in some cave in Africa or somewhere. So the fossil record is something that just keeps changing and can explode overnight with a new find, and people don't realize that. So you think go ahead, Jeannie.
It's got so many gaps in it. That's the problem for me scientifically, is when you see all these gaps. So that's questionable.
Now, you were telling me when we talked on the phone, and here, folks, we entered Jeannie territory. You were telling me about St. Francis and dogs. No, it was, yes, St. Francis and dogs. Pick up on that, would you? Hi, Jeannie?
Sorry?
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you not hear me again?
I didn't for a second. I don't know if something's loose on your end, because this is entirely different equipment now on my end. So, but
well, when I call back, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. We're all right.
Okay. So I was asking about St. Francis and dogs.
You want to go the St. Francis route, huh?
Yeah. I just said, I think you didn't hear me probably. That's the Jeannie route.
There's a legend about St. Francis. Well, first of all, let's talk about how when St. Francis prayed, and he liked to pray outside, that many, many, many different species of mammals would come. Well, not only mammals, birds would come too. But the legend that you're referring to is the wolf legend. There was a rabid wolf, and he was supposed to be huge, 115, 120 pounds, and the villagers were going to go kill him. And they had their torches, and, you know, they're on their killing mission. And St. Francis comes out and says, you know, what are you doing? And they told him that they were going to kill this rabid wolf, and he said, would you please allow me to go with you? And so the story goes that he went, and they found the rabid wolf, and before the villagers could kill him, St. Francis knelt with him and prayed. And from that day on, the legend says, that the wolf was inseparable from St. Francis. Well, that's always been regarded as sort of a fairy tale myth, nice little, you know, legend, until the excavations started in Assisi. I think that was in 2001 or 2002, and they found this very elaborate tomb. And they thought that it was one of St. Francis's brothers, because the tomb was clearly ornate and clearly meant for someone who was very, very important. Make a long story short, the excavation revealed that the tomb belonged to a wolf. And they did radiometric dating on the wolf to make sure it was of Francis's time, and isotopic dating, and the wolf was actually rabid. So the story appears to have some scientific validity to it.
Are you there still?
I'm here.
Oh, did you hear stop that? Talking? I wonder if I've lost you again.
I was going to keep talking then.
You better just keep talking. Or don't let too big a gap go by and my heart goes thump. I've lost my guest again.
So there's some scientific validity to that.
Yeah.
And you might want to look that up because they actually excavated that and that's what they found. That wolf was enshrined in a massive tomb.
Now, Jeannie, you said that we all yearn for love. We don't want to be lonely. You know, I think that is like the main characteristic of the human species, even though we behave so badly toward each other, that the unique, or at least that's not unique, other species have this, including dogs, and many species yearn for each other's company. That's very clear. But there's something so deep in our yearning for a kind of personal, emotional, spiritual attachment to each other that has a quality far beyond all other creatures except perhaps dogs.
I don't buy it. I think all mammals have it. I really do. And I think that we're way behind on the science here, too, because we've only studied so few, such as the chimp, the elephant, the wolf, the dog. But as we keep looking, we'll see. It's innate in our mammalian species. And when you look at mammals, they go back to the beginning of the Mesozoic age. I mean, we're talking a long time now. So I don't think it's just dogs and humans. I really don't. I think if you look around the natural world, you can see in these attachment patterns, that's what's driving attachment, is this feeling of safety and security and love.
Well, you know, in my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, I start on the premise that it all really begins with the first little tiny shrew-like figure millions of years ago, maybe as big as a pinky, who was nursing its infant.
Yep, in the Mesozoic era, that's right.
So talk some about that. I mean, you really believe, and you really helped me think more about the fact that the nursing process is the key to humanity. How's that? And that's a good sentence. The nursing process is the key to humanity.
It is the biological mechanism that interlocks all mammals. And what it does is secure and solidify attachment. And if you think about baby mammals, let's do humans for a second. We used to believe that human beings could not see at birth. Really, we did. And we told people that, parents, he won't be able to see till he's about 8 weeks old. Well, we know now that human babies have perfect vision at 8 to 10 inches. And that's no coincidence that the breast is 8 to 10 inches. That was meant to be that way. It was meant to solidify attachment, that you could look into your mother's eyes, that you could detect her smell. Did you know that? That is so crazy that if you are exclusively breastfed, you can detect your mother's smell 100% of the time. There is no error. If you're formula fed, you can detect your mother's smell about 35% of the time. And some of your listeners might be saying, who cares? Well, from an evolutionary perspective, you had to be able to know your mother's smell if your line was going to survive. So breastfeeding is so much more than nutrition. It really is the core of attachment. It really is, because it requires skin-to-skin contact. It requires that you know this sort of what I refer to as this ancient primordial dyadic dance. All mammals have to go through this. What? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just laughing. It's so good what you're saying. Go ahead.
So many people think it's just nutrition, but it's really the core of attachment, the skin-to-skin contact, feeling safe and protected. And it's even through the nighttime hours. I know in modern-day America we get so hung up on this co-sleeping debate, but 80 to 90% of human beings today are practicing co-sleeping, and 100% of other mammals in the wild, not in zoos or experimental labs, but in the wild, practice co-sleeping because you have to nurse through the night and you have to protect your young because there's predators. And sorry to say this, but in the human species, we have predators too. And when are they most active? At night.
That's so interesting. You know, I have two Shetland sheepdogs. One of them is Gail, and she is the grandmother of the little one, Sherry. Sherry just is the runt of the litter, so she looks much smaller than her grandmother. And Sherry, though she's 3 years old now, since she got here when she was about 9 months old, she has always wanted to rest as much as possible against her grandmother.
Absolutely.
So she's co-napping to this very day.
She's co-napping.
And we question it, Now, are they going to be psychologically damaged? Well, if that theory is correct, then 80 to 90% of the human beings across the globe are psychologically damaged. And if you really look at statistics, you know, we're the damaged country. 80 to 90% of all serial killers reside in the United States of America, which is 5% of the world's population. Where something's wrong with us.
And you think it has a great deal to do with the fact that the bonds between mother, one specific mother, and infant have been tortured and broken?
Absolutely, 100% I do. And I also will take it a step further. I've actually published in this area that not only does it fracture that attachment or that emotional bond, but it makes the mother much more likely to accept a diagnosis about her child. If you have this rock-solid attachment and somebody from the school that has no training in psychiatry or neurology or anything else is telling you that your little boy has ADHD, you know, you're going to question that. But if you've never had that attachment, you don't know them anyway, so, you know, they probably know better than me. They're the experts.
Both of us believe, and both of us learned this in part years and years and decades ago from John Bowlby, the British psychoanalyst, psychologist, evolutionary theorist, that the most fundamental experience of anxiety is about the loss of attachment, and that it begins very, very early. Say something more about that.
I think he could not be more right on. And you know what I really believe? And, of course, I can't prove this. We threw his theory in the ditch because it doesn't fit with culturally constructed scripts from the 21st century. We don't like his theory because his theory talks about that attachment is innate and that the core of attachment is time. That is who your attachment person is going to be, not who feeds you or whose DNA you share. It's time where you feel safe and secure. Now, so we don't like that theory because we're a nation of putting 42-day-old babies. Think about that, Dr. Bragan, 42-day-old human beings in a daycare with uninvested strangers raising you for your formative years. This has never been done before in the history of human beings. And now we're asking, why are we having all these problems? We don't have any attachment. We're scared. We're alone. We're lost.
Folks, because there was so much confusion at the beginning of the show, I'm not sure how much is going to come through actually on the final recording, but I want to once again introduce my dear friend, Jeannie Stolzer. She's at the University of Nebraska in Kearney. She's a professor of child and adolescent development. And she is a very wise, knowledgeable, scientific person. And I think the issues we're talking about today with Jeannie are among the most important in all human life. That the first few months, and certainly the first 3 to 5 years, have an enormous amount to do with everything that we call anxiety, guilt, shame, that we call mental illness, and so on. And Jeannie, talk some more about your own research in this area of of comparing the mother-infant bonding in different cultures, in part is reflected in the nursing schedules and the length of nursing, and talk and what goes on now in the Western industrialized nations.
We don't even look humans, like humans. I'm sorry to be so blunt. But when you look at other cultures and compare them to the United States of America, we don't even look like humans maternally. In other cultures, you have your baby, and you have your baby non-drugged. And people say, well, why wouldn't women want pain relief? It's not about pain relief. I mean, of course it is when you're given an epidural, which is a cane derivative. But when you drug a mother at birth, she can't nurse. When the baby is born drugged, and when you think about this, the drugs we're giving mothers, such as in the epidural, that drug is based on the weight of the mother, which is 20 to 35 times more than the baby. So, of course, it's the baby who's born most drugged. So he can't latch on. I mean, he's in a drug-induced stupor. So that's initially what happens, what we do here that doesn't look anything like other cultures. Our babies are born drugged. And if you ever see a non-drugged baby at birth, it's absolutely amazing. They are so alert. Do you know if you lay a brand-new born baby on his mother's pelvis, this is no drugs, immediately after birth, that baby can find his mother's breast. And, of course, if he's drugged, he can't. He's immobile. So that's the first thing we do is we drug the women and drug the babies. And then we do all kinds of crazy culturally constructed things. Like we put him upstairs on the third floor in a crib with a baby monitor. We don't see that in other cultures. They sleep with their mothers. And then we do crazier things, like taking them to daycare at 42 days old. In other cultures, the baby's worn on the mother. And I get so tired of being called anti-feminist. You're an anti-feminist because you talk like this and you write like this. No, 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 no. Women have always worked since the beginning of time. It was never separated. Women had to go to work and be mothers. So they strapped their babies on them. They went to the fields and worked. Today, what we've done is we've separated what I call the public and private spheres. Can't take your baby in the public sphere. So you go to work and take the baby to the daycare. When did we get like this? We're human beings. We need our mothers. We can't be separated from them for 70, 80 hours a week and then expect that there's not going to be any problems. So the main core of attachment theory is breastfeeding, co-sleeping, staying in close physical proximity to your young in their formative years. And that doesn't mean hovering or helicoptering or smothering. And I want to make that distinction very clear. Attachment mothering has nothing to do with neurotic mothering. Neurotic mothering comes from fear. So you're scared. No, don't do that. You can't do this. Don't do that. You'll break your neck. It has none to do with attachment mothering. Attachment mothering respects and understands certain developmental processes, and allows freedom within limits, but you're there if you're needed. That's the key. Was that too much of a ramble?
Oh, God, no. You can just keep on rambling as far as I'm concerned. People really need to hear this. There was a comment on your that was made on PRN for your first show, which was, wow, wonderful genie. I'd just never heard of attachment theory. I'd never heard of anxiety from the early attachment issues. And no, it's just so important. It's just so missing. It is so
missing,
incredibly missing everywhere
fit.
In our culture, in our sciences and psychology. Just, and of course, it's absent in psychiatry. They'd drug all the infants at birth if they could.
Absolutely, they would. And most human beings in America, and of course I don't have data to back this up, it's just my gut instinct. Most of us walk around and we feel just a little like something's missing. And we don't know what it is because we really don't feel so safe and we can't put our finger on it. Why do I feel like this? And my theory is it goes right back to the very beginning. Did you feel safe from the beginning? And Erickson, you know, he touches on this. But the first year, trust versus mistrust, that's when we're determining if this world is a safe place or not. And none of your listeners can remember anything when they were 6 months or 9 months, so they think, oh, that time doesn't matter. According to many theorists, those are critical, pivotal points in human development. And most of us didn't feel safe when we were little. We were always wondering, where is she? Am I safe? Oh, God, who's that? Many of us, like me, never were suckled. And I'm certainly not blaming my mother. A doctor in Schuyler, Nebraska, told my mother that her milk was poison. That's why I wasn't nursed.
Oh, boy.
And we're still doing that, by the way. And please have your listeners check what I'm going to say, because I know it sounds absolutely unbelievably false. Still today, in 2015, pediatricians, OBGYNs, general practitioners, these are our family physicians most likely to work with women, have no training in human lactation. They really don't. So we've lost our role models. Nobody nurses anymore, so we don't know who to ask. So we go to the doctor, and we say, is he doing okay? Am I nursing all right? And the doctor says, no, he's not gaining enough weight. Start with formula. When he has no training in it, so you might as well go ask the plumber down the street. So we've got to question this. Physicians are the experts at nursing when they have no education in human lactation. They may have had one dyadic course, but that's it. That doesn't make you an expert.
Well, you know, the pediatricians, the so-called behavioral pediatricians, they don't know anything about this. They don't know anything about really human behavior, because this is the foundation, the early years of life, the sense of security, the love, closeness with the mother, it's the foundation of human life. And you put it so well in terms of mammals, that we're no longer behaving like mammals. There has to be terrible, terrible consequences for that.
We really are starting to look a lot more reptilian. And I don't mean to sound like a science fiction advocate or anything like that, but really, look what reptiles do. Think of the alligator. She goes down, now digs her hole, lays her eggs, and she's gone. There's no nursing.
Well, the cowbird.
There's no co-sleeping.
The cowbird literally finds some other bird's nest, puts the eggs in it, and says, you raise them.
Yeah, you raise them. Go. Yep, I'm done. I got more important things to do.
Well, I got to follow the cattle, so you better raise it. At least that had some evolutionary use for the cowbird who was busy following the cows and the cattle. It's not really good for humans. Wow.
No, it's not. And this was a national cohort study done. Let's see, when was it done? 2007, 2008. I was so astonished when this national data came out. I couldn't even walk for 2 days. I was so surprised. It asked women, these are women with children 3 years of age and younger who are employed full-time. Asked these women, why are you employed? A, economic necessity. B, personal fulfillment. C, other. And it was left so the qualitative analysis could take place. 77% of American women with children 3 years of age and younger are reporting they're working for personal fulfillment. How did we convince a whole generation of women that raising children is not personally fulfilling? I mean, I've published a lot of places, and I'm pretty well known, but there's nowhere where I am more important than as in my role as mother. And my boy's old. He's 23 years old. But still, that's my most paramount role, because I understand that I am irreplaceable there. I'm not irreplaceable anywhere else. Here I am.
Well, I do think you're irreplaceable. I think you're irreplaceable in my life, and I hope as time goes on you become increasingly irreplaceable in our intellectual life of this country and the world. Jeannie, is there a large movement out there in the world today of people who agree with you, either women's organizations or intellectual conferences or journals? I mean, is there any broad support for the kinds of things you're talking about? And in that same vein, is there much of a continuation out there of the work of John Bowlby?
Oh, boy, that's a big, long question. Evolutionary psychologists are in with me, most. I'm not going to paint with a broad stroke. Many archaeologists, some journals, the Journal of Human Lactation. What's that? There's a journal out of Sydney, Australia that's really big, too. I think it's just called Breastfeeding. But, yeah, there's some pretty prominent voices, but as far as Bowlby's successor, you know, and I'm sorry, you may totally and vehemently disagree with me on this, and that's okay. We can disagree. Ainsworth is touted as Bowlby's successor, but I don't see it. I know she was his student, and I know she worked, blah, blah, blah. I know all that. But what Ainsworth tried to do was quantify attachment with the strange situation test. She wanted to quantify it. She loved attachment theory so much, she wanted to empirically quantify it. And it can't be quantified. So, you know, I think, and maybe this is going to sound really egotistical for me to say, but of the scholars that I'm aware of, I'm the only one that is a Bowlby purist that's writing today.
So I didn't know that, but I kind of suspected maybe. Well, good, good, good. God bless you. I mean, you've meant a great deal to me in terms of giving me, really returning me to the foundation because, you know, I did read Bowlby when I was young, and but I kind of didn't connect very much to it until you reminded me all about that, and I started reading them again.
Oh, you'll love this story. Years ago, when I was trying to become a professor, I was interviewing at Rhode Island. And one of the questions that I had was, okay, I want you to pretend like you're a theorist and we're going to ask you questions. I said, great, okay, I'm going to be John Bowlby. The dean of the College of Social Sciences looks me right in the eye and said, no, Bowlby's theory's been cast aside. Who else do you want to be?
Oh, my goodness gracious. That
is shocking.
Didn't
want to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We tried our best to whitewash him from history because it doesn't fit in with what we're doing. Because here's the bottom line, Dr. Bragan. If
By the way,
Jeannie, theory is
call me,
correct,
call me Peter on the air, would you?
Okay, Peter.
Yes,
if Bowlby's theory is correct, the United States of America is in hellacious trouble.
Is it pretty much the same in all the industrialized nations?
No, it's not, because they have federal policies that ensure maternal leave. Sweden, Austria, England, Italy, Israel. I mean, you can go all around the country. I mean, all around the globe. No, they're not in trouble like we are because they give paid maternity leave.
And are there measurements to show that women use that maternity leave to be mothers?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Norway, for example, 98% of babies are breastfed at birth. 92% are breastfed at 6 months, 85% are breastfed at 12 months, and 60% are breastfed 2 years or more. Does it sound anything like us?
That would look weird here in the U.S.
Oh, it would. And they have, by the way, Norway has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. Nobody can touch them.
I wonder what their rate for highly disturbed behavior is in adults. I mean, so many other factors could go into that, but you'd think this would be protective against a certain amount of craziness among us as adults.
Oh, I absolutely concur with what you're saying, especially in, well, yeah, I would go the broad spectrum, except I'd argue with it with ADHD. And here's why. In my mind, ADHD is just a bioevolutionary behavior. There's running, jumping, climbing, fidgeting, not paying attention.
That you might even get more. You might even get more of that with the kids being more energetic and feeling safer and able to go running off and doing things. And
exactly.
I really do think, folks, that the children who are really given a lot of good, strong nurturing early on, they're not spoiled. They're stronger. They grow up to be more independent. I think that's the nature, as Jeannie is saying, of being a mammal. One of the things that I want to also say, I even used to use the metaphor that it takes a village to raise a child, but it really takes a mother. And I think it was you, Jeannie, who said to me, and it takes a village to support the mother.
Absolutely. Yes, it really, truly, truly does.
So what kind of data do we have on the subject of what nursing was like 25,000 years ago when we were Homo sapiens, identical to today? Most of us living in Africa, but many of us moving out to live in Europe and eventually and in the Middle East and toward the rest of the world. What do we know about what relationships were like back then? How much do we know? I've been studying that. I'm still asking questions. What's your idea about how much we know about then?
I think we know quite a lot, because we live in a time now that we have scientific analyses that can answer some of these questions for us. What we know about children living in prehistoric societies is, number one, they had other foods introduced other than human milk between 18 and 36 months old. And on average, they were breastfed 3 to 7 years. Now, if you think about that, it makes sense bioevolutionarily speaking, because the foods that were available at that time were things like nuts and berries, you know, dried meats, things you need molars to eat. You can't eat those with little baby teeth in the front. So they were exposed to the full range of a human diet when they were 5 to 7, when molar eruption occurs in humans. So we look very, very, very different than we do now. I mean, right now in America, less than 12% of babies are breastfed 6 months or longer. I mean, that is crazy when you think about mammals. And mammals nurse based on longevity. So an elephant, for example, will nurse 6 to 8 years. A horse, 2 to 3, if left to their own devices. I'm not talking about these ranchers that are taking the horses away. It's based on gestational time, how long you're in utero, and how long the lifespan is. Conversely, a rat, whose lifespan's 3 to 4 years, will nurse about 6 to 8 weeks. So we're very, very different than our ancient ancestors.
I guess you're basing this partly just on what was edible. Is there data that we can get from bones or other sources that give us an idea that the people were nurturing this long?
Absolutely. Do you want names? I can.
Well, no, you don't have to do that. But there's research that's pretty strong in this area.
Absolutely.
It fits with other anthropological or paleoanthropologic studies, which suggest that children actually had much more supportive lives in general, infants and children, from other human beings early on. They had other threats. That we don't have, and that they didn't have the medicines we have, the public health kinds of things that we have. But they had much stronger relationships, so that the human brain, by the time it develops fully, somewhere between 50 and 150,000 years ago, the human brain actually developed in response to a highly nurturing involvement with multiple levels of people doing nurturing, older siblings, other women, other men, grandparents, that it was a highly nurturing environment, although each child, if the parent hadn't died, had its mother. And that would go along also with the longer nurturing, and it makes for such a different picture of how we evolved than we can conceive of today without really expanding our minds considerably to try to imagine this close-knit family life where a huge amount of the effort is going toward survival of and growth and development of the infants with a lot of caring and a lot of loving going on. And maybe if our theory is correct, with a lot of puppies running around helping out with the loving.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought that up because we know from archaeological evidence that human mothers were not alone. When their kids got old enough that they weren't strapped on their bodies anymore, you know, you have a 2-year-old or 3-year-old, they love to explore, they love to climb and jump and run. You can't tie them on your body for 8 hours a day. So their sisters were watching them. Their aunts were helping. Their grandmothers, other invested women in the family. They had all of these important, important women that were all around. And men's function was very critical to the children. It was just much different. Sorry to say this, and I hope you don't get too many calls on it, but I'm going to say it anyway. Men were not, you know, changing diapers and playing. They had a much more important function, which was the survival of their family. So they were the hunters. They were the protectors. They were the warriors. They were the builders, which was critical for their children's survival. But children always had access to many, many loving people all around them, and we don't have that anymore. Now grandma lives in Fort Lauderdale, and grandpa's in Sarasota, and, you know, aunts are in Nevada. It's what have we done?
Wow. I'm taking a deep breath and just sort of taking this in. I just hope a lot of people are going to listen to this. It's so much the key to the distress of modern life. You know, I don't joke when I say that existential anguish is an intellectual's explanation of not getting enough love when he was tiny.
I love when you say that because it is so very true. It is so true. But here's the question. How did we convince this brand new generation that how much money you make or the letters behind your name, that's what makes you important. That's what makes you a productive, contributing member of society. How do we do that? I mean, that is crazy. And yeah, I'm talking about women. I'm talking about me. How did we convince women that being a lawyer, being a professor, is so much more important than raising that child? And guess what? Here's what I know as a mother. Being little, they're little for such a short period of time. Then you can do anything you want to. Because when they get into adolescence, they don't want anything to do with you. And if you're like most Americans, you put your child in school at 5. So then you have that 8 hours. They're not with you. But that first 4 to 5 years, it is critical that they feel safe, that they feel loved, that they feel, as Bowlby would say, I have a secure base. I'm all right. I can explore. I can do this.
Yeah, I suspect that if we could do the right studies, we would find that at the age of 5, you have the person who will be recognizable for the as a personality for the rest of his or her life.
You know, I really think so, too. And Freud thought it, too, and they threw him out. But I think you're right. I think you're right.
I mean, we can do a lot, a great deal to grow and change after that. But I think that a lot of that best change comes from other nurturing relationships where we get smarter and overcome our issues from childhood and learn to have closeness, intimacy, and love as adults, which then continues that nurturing process.
Absolutely. And if you notice, Bowlby, I love how he says this. He said baby mammals need their mothers or permanent mother substitute.
Yeah.
And people get confused with that. What is a permanent mother substitute? Well, they're doing everything. What does a mother do? They love you, they protect you, they guide you, they discipline you, blah, blah, blah. And it's secure. It doesn't change. So Bowlby didn't care if it was a man or a woman or blah, 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 blah. Well, that's probably not true, because no matter how far advanced we become, men cannot carry you in their uterus and they cannot nurse you from their mammary glands. But if we're talking strictly about security, he didn't care about anatomy.
Yeah. You know, and this is something I want to suggest, too, for folks, you know, who are listening. The description that Jeannie just gave of people, of a mother nurturing, caring for, protecting, looking after for, it is really possible to have adult relationships like that. It is really possible to have a partner in life where each of you mutually looks after the other, protects the other, nurtures the other, helps the other go through tough times. And I think that the really good marriages and the really good long-term relationships have a huge amount of nurturing, protective quality to them. It's just simply impossible for us to alone throughout life to do such a good job at that as we can do with a companion.
I think my experience
teaches me that.
I think you're right. And back to your initial topic about dogs, I really do believe this. For people who have been hurt in so many ways, emotionally, physically, sexually, whatever way or ways, during their childhood, their formative years, adolescence, dogs can truly help reverse that. I don't want to in any way sound deterministic or reductionistic, that if in the first 5 years, you know, you weren't safe and secure and loved, that you're doomed. I don't want that to be the message. I have to have hope. And I think that dogs, it may sound crazy, but I believe it because I've experienced it, that they can help you with trust, that they can help you with unconditional love. As a matter of fact, they can be your teacher. Does that sound too crazy? Because I absolutely believe it. They can help heal us. And I think that's what they were sent here to do.
Well, it's certainly my experience as a child, my closest companion, without a doubt, for many, many years, up to high school, probably, and certainly before high school, was my dog.
Yep.
I went everywhere.
Think of the lessons. What was the dog's name?
The dog's name was Pitch, P-I-T-C-H. He was a huge black dog that was originally gotten when my brother and I were younger. And he was like bigger than a German Shepherd. And he was a dog who, if he saw a fight, I mean, I actually worked on morality with him. If he saw a fight between dogs, he would just stand in between them. And none of them would dare take him on. And one day, Jeannie, he had a broken leg. He got hit by a car, and he had a cast on. So the local boxer, who was a bully of the boxer dog, and was, you know, pretty good size, decided to attack him and go after his throat, and he was kind of rearing back. He was just trying to keep back because he couldn't really get into a fighting position to defend himself on three legs. And that was the first time I ever risked myself thoroughly for another human being. I was playing badminton with my first girlfriend, and I just charged that boxer, and I beat the badminton to pieces, and then turned it over and just clubbed him till he ran away.
Mm-hmm.
I learned with my dog really, really caring in a way that I simply did not get in my own home. There was just no question about it.
That's exactly my experience, and I think we should sit down tonight and write what Pitch taught us, what Hank taught us, what Jack taught us. Because anybody that hasn't had, and you know, I got to say this, I used to be really mad at people that sort of belittled the human dog love connection thing. But now, as I'm getting much older, I just feel sorry for them. They haven't felt that. They've never experienced that, and I have. And I think, no, I know that that has made me a better person. But they're my teachers.
Have you read the books of Jeffrey Mason, another friend of mine? Masson. He's written books about dogs never lie about love is one of them. The dog who couldn't stop loving is another one. When Elephants Weep, which is about all animals, is another one. And Jeffrey's books also helped me see dogs in a more important light, for how unique they are, how there's no other animal on earth like them, including us in some positive ways. They have qualities of trustworthiness and of forgiveness and not carrying a grudge and of just loving us no matter how bad we are. He's written beautifully about that.
I have to find those books, but it does remind me of the sayings of the Desert Fathers 2,000 years ago, that they wrote that a dog is better than I am because he loves but does not judge.
Yes. Or as another bumper sticker, you know, God, give me the grace to be as wonderful as my dog thinks I am.
Yes, I love it. I have something like that on my refrigerator.
Yeah. Folks, this isn't soft stuff. This isn't nonsense. We're really talking very much, I think, about the essence of life right now. The essence of human life, which derives, as Jeannie has said, and I've written about it in Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, is essentially a mammalian life writ large and with great spirituality. And it's really important that one thing, and Darwin was very clear on this, that we rise above the so-called animal nature by having free will and choice and learning to love. So the idea of our evolution and our evolution with dogs is not deterministic. And read carefully The Descent of Man, Darwin's Descent of Man, where he says on more than one occasion that human biological evolution is not the whole story and cannot explain the highest human standards that we've evolved. And for him, that highest human standard was the golden rule. You know, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And I think there's also a rule beyond that, which is we should simply love one another that we achieve very sporadically. It goes even beyond the, you know, do to others as you'd have them do to you, but rather do unto others in a loving way. Be a source of love. And this is the essence of it, folks. This is what it's all about. We are going to come to an end. I want to remind folks that you've been listening to me, of course, Peter Pragin, and my friend. You've been in on a personal conversation between me and Jeannie Stolzer, Stolzer. You can find Jeannie on the web, professor at Kearney, Nebraska, and one of the good influences in my life. Jeannie, any
thank you so
words?
Very much.
Okay, Jeannie, and I will be talking to you some more.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, folks. I hope that you've enjoyed this hour as much as I have.